have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. This is going to be an extremely intense hour. First, the latest on health and healing. We're going to talk about think again before you eat the meat. Also, the saturated fat that's also comes from the meat. And then, what can we do to help postmenopausal women with depression? Also, there's some antidepressant use and stress, plus a high-fat diet. That is a bad combination. Life-extending mechanisms of rhodiola, that's important. And a new antioxidant shows promise in Parkinson's disease. Those are some of the topics that will empower people, all from good quality independent research and peer-reviewed. I have two guests today. One is a newsmaker, a short guest. I'm going to be directly addressing Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and others that they bring on to their station. When O'Reilly says that they have not been listening to our telephone calls or reading our emails, and if the president said they are not doing that on Charlie Rose yesterday, and they did, he said that's an impeachable offense. We'll provide evidence then that Mr. O'Reilly should be examining. I will have Steve Cohen. He is one of the nation's leading advocates for corporate and government whistleblowers, and he has a 25-year record of court victories on behalf of individuals bringing truth to the public about corruption, fraud, and misdemeanors. And he is the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center and a trustee of the National Whistleblowers Legal Defense Fund. Then I will be sharing specific and direct quotes from Washington Blog on spying on Americans before 9/11, and that how the National Security Agency built a backdoor into all Windows software by 1999. Also separately, Obama and his allies say the government doesn't listen to your phone calls, but the FBI begs to differ, from Max Blumenthal. Max Blumenthal is an award-winning journalist in Washington, D.C. He has also produced documentaries. He writes for the New York Times, The Nation, Huffington Post, etc., and he is the senior writer for the Daily Beast. I will be quoting him. So we will provide information that obviously they don't have. And then over to the Sean Hannity idea that it's all right. You know, we should be spying on everyone. In fact, he wants us spying all the time on everyone, so he said. And that both on O'Reilly and on Hannity, I've heard it now stated that this guy's not a real whistleblower, the Snowden guy. No, if he were, he would have gone through the system. Well, according to those who did go through the system, it doesn't work. And what he did was the right thing, but we're told that the National Security Agency spying prevented terrorist attacks on Wall Street. No, it didn't. The evidence that they're grasping at straws from the Christian Science Monitor. Today, I will share specifics and the Associated Press of how the two issues put up there by the National Security Agency. Oh, if we didn't spy on everyone, we wouldn't have known about these attacks. Yes, you do spy on everyone, and no, it hasn't helped us in these attacks, and we'll show you why. So it's just necessary to deal with these. And if time permits, I'm very concerned when Anderson Cooper provides a forum for those who would attack Snowden, which is their right, but then does not go into the background of the people who are doing the attacking. Why not? Why not give us the background so we know this person who's coming on there, who's attacking King, have you done your homework on this person? Do you know what this person's background is? We do. We'll tell you, and why the people who are making the statements against Snowden themselves have no credibility whatsoever. We have a busy show. Let's begin. First on meat from the National University of Singapore. Quote, if you consume more red meat over the long term, you have a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. That's from the National University of Singapore, reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Now, this is a follow-up of three studies involving 149,000 Americans. That's a good amount of people. And they found a substantial increase in type 2 diabetes. So, what do we take away from this? Well, for those who may not yet be enamored by the American diet, we take away the idea that what we eat directly impacts our health. And therefore, if we don't want colorectal cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, dementia, Alzheimer's, stroke, then we had better make healthier choices. Now, competing against that information, and it's been out there for a while, is our conditioned taste and most of the shows, almost all the shows on television. The programs on television show people, the latest being this hamburger, where a guy goes around the United States and interviews people and shows their hamburgers being made and why the people love their hamburgers. And more, these are not just small hamburgers, but huge hamburgers. The irony of it is that not once does a person ask a question, what's going to happen when this hamburger goes into my mouth, in my body? Why is it that almost 95% of the people I see in these restaurants are obese? And if we were to do a thorough medical evaluation, would we find that they are at risk of diabetes, heart disease, stroke, cancer? The answer would be yes, because of the red meat and all the studies about what's bad about red meat, but also the studies on saturated fat. It's all bad. The saturated fat and then the French fries that go with it and then the salt. Here's the latest from Health Day, as reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association publication Neurology. Quote, saturated fat may make the brain vulnerable to Alzheimer's. Researchers say a new study shows that fat can increase the chemicals in the brain, and it's bad. But cutting the fat would be good and protect you against Alzheimer's disease. All right, and this was done at Wake Forest School of Medicine. So let's put these two together. We know that when we eat animal proteins, it's our primary source of saturated fat. Then we know that people are eating a lot of chicken and pork, as well as beef. They're eating a lot of dairy. All of this is saturated fat. There are some healthy saturated fats like coconut oil. This is not what we're talking about. So you're getting two things simultaneously. You're getting protein that can cause diabetes and saturated fat in the same meat that can cause Alzheimer's. Then there's others that they didn't talk about that we have dealt with separately, and that is that when you cook the meat at the temperature needed to destroy some of the bacteria, you also create a chemical called heterocyclic amines, and that contributes to cancer, stomach cancer, colorectal cancer. So there are three bad things about meat. Now, here's the interesting part of this. The consumption of fast foods and meats is increasing, not decreasing. So it's not about a lack of information or quality information. It's about we as a nation, there are individuals that are excluded, certainly, but as a nation, once we become a part of fads and once we start ritualizing our social patterns like eating out at a fast food place or rushing home and not having time to go to a market or health food store or food co-op and our own backyard and select our vegetables and make a good meal, slow food, slow cooking, healthy eating, healthy family, get together. Instead, we have adapted to this hyper-spastic social relationship where we're texting, we're glued to these stupid computers all day long. We don't even have the capacity for articulation, let alone the proper use of grammar. nor the manners to do so, nor the patience to listen. All the while, we're wolfing down as much as we can of whatever taste we like, irrespective of what it means to our body and the ultimate goal of eating, our health. As a result, we stand in absolute defiance, a smackdown to everything that is both spiritual and reasonable, as if we can defy cause and effect. And indeed, in the short term, it seems like we can. We can drink a lot. We can binge drink. We can smoke. We can do drugs. We can eat any kind of garbage imaginable. And for the short time, we get away with it. And then we don't. And then we have our heart attacks and strokes and our cancer and our dementia and our hyperactive personalities and then our divorces and our bankruptcies and our stupidity. And we vote for Obama and we vote for Bush and we vote for other people because we're just stupid. And it doesn't matter what you wrap yourself in. And we love to wrap ourselves in the flag and slogans. We love ritualistic positions. But we never question the nature of the ritual. And why do we need this ritual? We don't need rituals. We just need common sense and reason. And we lack both. So, now try to compete with that. And try to compete with your friends and peers and relatives who are also a part of it. Then an article showing you what's wrong with that doesn't make a whole lot of difference for those who are already a part of it. But it does make a difference for those who are giving themselves one more reason to make a healthy choice. 5 years ago, I conducted a study. It was my 43rd study. And up to that point, there have been about 35,000 individuals in those studies. They are lifestyle and behavior modification studies, measuring what happens when people make and sustain change. This particular study was on menopause and postmenopause. To get into the study, you had to be in menopause or postmenopause. And then we measured 37 different changes that occur in most women during that period of time, and we wanted to see what would happen with substantial changes. The results were spectacular. Fortunately, we filmed it, we recorded it, people kept the diaries, we had blood workups, hormone levels before and after, and five of the women had reverse menopause, the oldest being 8 years postmenopause, now was premenopause. Skin was like new, hair growing full, nails shiny and pink and hard. The woman said, "It looks like I've had a facelift, Gary," and I haven't. I have to keep telling my friends because they don't understand that the collagen and reconnecting. And I said, "That's fine. It's not important what your friends believe. It's your face you're looking in the mirror, not theirs. So don't look at yourself through their eyes or their mindset." We were able to reverse night sweats, hot flashes, thinning of the bones, osteoporosis, inflammation, depression, hypothyroidism. This is the latest study. University of Massachusetts Medical School, quote, postmenopausal women who use antidepressant medication, that's most women, or suffer from depression might be more likely to have a higher body mass index, larger waist circumference, and inflammation, all associated with an increased risk of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And that's according to the study published in the American Journal of Public Health. They are absolutely correct. In fact, that's what we started with. Now, here's where monotheistic thinking and just unfortunately the limitations of the mind in academia, because you're so protected, you're so enabled, if you're tenured. Not everyone, but most. The research is just highly repetitive. You can find 1,000 studies, all funded by the government or someone that doesn't care about the outcome, that does the same identical work. And this is especially true in cancer research, for example. You'll see the same study done over and over, and you're thinking, why are they doing this? Well, because they're not very bright. And because as long as you do what you're supposed to, you're always going to have that grant awarded. why didn't they see what would happen if you change that? Why not ask women, are you willing to change most of your lifestyle and almost all of your diet and exercise and dealing with stress? I don't believe that they think that people are capable of this. We know they're capable because we've seen the results. Massive change, positive change. 96% of the people who went through this study had major changes and have sustained them since because we do follow-ups. That's the study I'd like to see them do. So in the fall, I'll be doing another one, but adding in some other factors to it. And show them, I'm going to keep this and show them that postmenopausal women do not have to be depressed, do not have to be overweight, do not have to suffer from higher incidence of diabetes or cardiovascular disease. We can reverse it. We can save the lives and improve the quality of life of millions upon millions of women. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Bum, 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 bum. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Bum, 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 bum. Give him two lips like roses and clover. Bum, bum, bum. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall, our first newsmaker interview. Is on the line. I've given you his background. And Stephen has spent a long time with an admirable record spanning over 25 years of court victories on behalf of individuals bringing the truth to the public about corruption, fraud, and misdemeanors. He is the director, executive director of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington and a trustee of the National Whistleblowers Legal Defense and Education Fund. And his website is whistleblowers.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Doing great. I have but one question for you, but before I get to that question, I'm going to read some information. And this is a direct offer to Bill O'Reilly, who last evening said that based upon statements by President Obama on Charlie Rose, that we are not now, nor have we, been listening to people's phone calls nor reading their emails. O'Reilly said that, well, I have to give the benefit of a doubt to the president and the National Security Agency director because we don't have any evidence. And if it should turn out that President Obama has not told the truth, then that's an impeachable offense. That was O'Reilly. Then Sean Hannity said, you know, that, well, we need the National Security Agency and we need them spying on us because it prevents another 9/11 type of attack or a terrorist attack. So I'm going to address those two, and I would like you to address it also. So my question to you is this. From the whistleblowers that you have represented and the evidence they have whistleblown about, do you have any evidence that the National Security Agency or any governmental agency, including the FBI or CIA, has illegally wiretapped Americans, now I'm not talking about terrorists now, citizens, read their emails at any time, not just the present time?
Well, I think the better question is how many times? Thousands upon thousands. I've represented whistleblowers in the FBI for many years. The first big one was Fred Whitehurst at the crime lab, but after that, in many departments, including counterterrorism. And I represented a key whistleblower on the national security letter scandal, who ran a unit and actually also was an FBI interface with the NSA program. That was confidential, but the FBI itself told me he was the interface with the NSA. So my client couldn't even tell me that, but the FBI did. And it was documented that thousands of illegal national security letters and national security letter related searches were conducted over the period of years. It was also documented that the FBI issued policies that permitted the illegal collection of data. It was documented that the that the highest ranking counterterrorism official in the FBI personally requested illegal searches. It was documented that they did these things, these massive warrants or NSL letters where they would put on hundreds of phone numbers, none of which they had cause for. So the answer is yes, yes, and yes. Now, this is just the beginning of the problem, because once they conduct these illegal national security letter searches, which they did by the thousands, then they collect data and use that data to do even more invasive searches. So I don't know what the hell these people are talking about, what they're reading. This is public. The abuses are well documented, and that's why you have whistleblowers. You need whistleblowers on the inside who have the courage to report these events and try to fix them.
What would you say to Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, Laura Ingraham, the major, and Rush Limbaugh, who defend the National Security Agency, defend the FBI, even praise it, defend the military-industrial complex, and say that it's not so bad because of the safety that we are guaranteed because of their spying?
Okay, well, first off, I would include in that group many of the leading, more liberal commenters and op-ed journalists who've been also joining in the trashing of the most recent whistleblower. It's not just Republican. It's pretty bipartisan at this point, these attacks. But what I would say is this. The blind leading the blind. Since when did Bill O'Reilly et al. Become experts in counterterrorism or even have the slightest idea what an effective counterterrorism operation entails? And I've had the great honor of having worked directly with FBI employees who are among the absolute best and who've worked, and these employees have worked with CIA, NSA, the works on effective counterterrorism programs. And I've learned what it takes to do your job. And it does not take the over-collection of data. It does not take spying on millions of people or collecting billions of pieces of information. In fact, as I understand it, that can harm effective counterterrorism efforts by sending resources and wasting resources and not focusing on the real threat. I've had the absolute honor of representing a whistleblower who has been the FBI's highest-ranking Arab-American agent, its first legal attaché to Saudi Arabia, its highest-ranking fluent Arabic speaker, and one of the few recipients of what's known as the Director of Central Intelligence Award. This at the time was the most prestigious award given within the intelligence community, given to my client personally by the director of the CIA after being nominated by the director of the FBI for his brilliant counterterrorism work on Middle Eastern targets, specifically the Islamic group, which was the forerunner of Al-Qaeda, the blind sheikh, who was Osama bin Laden's spiritual leader, and what the terrorist organizations, which we call now Al-Qaeda. He was there. He did brilliant operations. He won the highest award. He prevented terrorist attacks. And I'll tell you, he's a whistleblower. And he points out and has pointed out that the overcollection of data is counterproductive, and what's needed is a more targeted approach with people who actually can speak Arabic, who have expertise in counterterrorism operations, and can do the job. So what I would say is, what makes you an expert and why are you spouting? Because what's at issue here is the protection of the United States, No one wants to see another successful major terrorism attack. A major terrorism attack will have catastrophic impact on civil liberties. So I think everyone's on the same page about wanting to prevent one. But what the page we don't see is the page of the whistleblower, the insider, who's looking at the problems and trying to report them. We don't see that page because when they stick their necks out, they get their heads chopped off. And what's going on now, which is really one of the most despicable things I've seen in my 30 years of representing whistleblowers, is this threat, not just an idle threat, but a real threat, of charging a loyal, patriotic American whistleblower with violation of the Espionage Act and threatening them with life imprisonment. We have moved so far beyond in the realm of national security from merely being afraid of being fired or having your career destroyed. They are threatening national security whistleblowers with life imprisonment. So the sources of information, the sources that are willing to report wrongdoing are drying up and will never learn the truth. But I can tell you right now, from the people I have represented inside the national security establishment with direct firsthand knowledge, who are some of the greatest agents and experts, they're whistleblowers, and their voices are not being heard, and now they're being silenced with some of the most vicious threats
coming from
to
the left,
livelihood and safety that has
Stephen,
ever happened in whistleblowing.
Stephen, some of those attacks are coming from the left.
Exactly, and it's really unfortunate that people aren't looking for the truth. People are viewing the events we're seeing today through partisan eyes. Some of them are partisan, and pretty much if the NSA says, let's monitor it, they'll say, I agree, let's monitor it, without any understanding or expertise in what the legitimate scope or parameters of monitoring should be. They're predisposed, and they're reflecting that. On the other hand, there are people predisposed to support the Democratic president that don't want to admit that this president is following the footsteps of Bush and others and has even gone further than Bush had gone in empowering a national security state. So they don't want to accept that. So they're attacking the whistleblower. Partisanship is poison in the area of whistleblowing. The whistleblower, and I've seen this hundreds of times, really wants to get the truth out, wants to get their voice out, wants to fix the problem. But once the whistleblower is swept up in partisanship, their voice is not heard, and the outcome is usually catastrophic for the whistleblower.
Finally, I'd like for you to listen to what Max Blumenthal has to say on this from Op-Ed News. Quote, Obama and his allies say the government doesn't listen to your phone calls, but the FBI begs to differ. Today, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers, Republican Michigan, insisted the National Security Agency has not been recording Americans' phone calls under any surveillance program and that any claim to the contrary was misinformation. Rogers' comments countered remarks from Representative Gerald Nadler, Democrat of New York, who said he was told in a House Judiciary Committee briefing by FBI Director Robert Mueller that private firms contracted by the National Security Agency could listen to phone calls made by American citizens. And then it goes on, and here's what he says. In a CNN Aaron Burnett May 1st interview, this is what the, according to FBI agent, former FBI agent Tim Clemente, made a startling revelation. According to Clemente, on April 18th, a phone call between Boston bombing perpetrator and his wife was retrieved by the FBI as part of its surveillance of bulk U.S. telecom data. Here's the relevant section of the Burnett and Clemente exchange. Quote, Burnett, Tim, is there any way? Obviously, there is a voicemail they can try to get the phone companies to give up that up to at some point. It's not a voicemail. It's just a conversation. There's no way they can actually find out what happened, right, unless she tells them? Clemente, no, there is a way. We certainly have ways in national security investigations to find out exactly what was said in that conversation. It's not necessarily something that the FBI is going to want to present in court, but it may help lead the investigation in or lead the questioning of her. We certainly can find that out. Burnett, so they can actually get that? People are saying, look, that's incredible. Clemente, no. Welcome to America. All that stuff is being captured as we speak, whether we know it or not, end quote. Well, of course, Clemente's comments completely undermine Rogers' claim that the government is not recording Americans' phone calls. It is, or otherwise it wouldn't get it. So here we have an FBI guy saying every single thing that is said by any American, they've got it. That means they have lied to us. They have all of our conversations because they can go back and retrieve anything you've said over the phone. And then during there was another briefing where Mueller offered a clue that the Bureau was seeking broad access to American phone records. That was on March 11th before the scan, 2011. Towards the end of his testimony, Mueller complained that, quote, our investigations can be stymied by the records preservation practices of private communication providers. Current law does not require telephone companies and internet service providers to retain customer subscriber information and source and destination data for any set period of time. And then a year later, the FBI formally requested that Congress expand the 1994 Communications for Law Enforcement Assistance Act to ensure that instant messaging and voice and email, all that, were wiretap friendly. And the FBI General Counsel Andrew Wiseman began the process by drafting legislation requiring online servers to add extra coding to their programs, providing the FBI a back door into consumer data, including emails and online chats. And this April, at a luncheon at the American Bar Association, the FBI Wiseman declared that the Bureau's, quote, top priority this year was to enhance its ability to monitor web-based services like Gmail, Google Voice, etc. So now, according to Bill Biney, who I just saw this morning in a very good interview on USA Today, he said the following. He and all the other major whistleblowers said that Snowden is a legitimate whistleblower and that, yes, they have been listening and looking all along. But he, Biney, a 40-year veteran, and the top guy there and that has defected and whistleblown, he said that for 7 years he did everything humanly possible in the chain of command to bring to the attention of all supervisors and members of Congress and congressional hearings what was going wrong, and no one did a single thing. And then the other three people there did the same thing, including a lawyer representing them, and then said that if no one's going to listen to you when you find crimes going on, then what's wrong with going outside and going directly to the press? So here we have individuals who are now being, or individual now being targeted for telling the truth when all these other whistleblowers tried to tell the truth, but nobody would listen. And by the way, that's not just national intelligence. At the FBI, the FDA, one of the top people there, I filmed, and he said that he found out about Vioxx causing higher incidence of heart attack and stroke, and went to the FDA head. They didn't want to do anything about it. So 60,000 Americans died because they wouldn't listen to him at the FDA. And for his efforts, he was given no power there. So the FBI has been monitoring phone calls and has been reading emails, as has the National Security Agency, because the FBI gets their information mainly through the National Security Agency. So it's lie after lie. And we just keep being lied on. Now, here's one more thing. This is from Washington Blog Global Research. Quote, Government-built spy access into most common popular consumer products was before 9/11. In researching the stunning pervasiveness of spying by the government, and it is much, much wider than what you've been told, we ran across the fact that the FBI wants software programmers to install a backdoor in all software. Digging a little further, we found a 1999 article by leading European computer publication Heise, which noted that the National Security Agency had already built a backdoor into all Windows software. A careless mistake by Microsoft programmers has revealed that special access codes prepared by the U.S. National Security Agency have been secretly built into Windows. The National Security Agency access system is built into every version of Windows operating system now in use, except early releases of the Windows 95 and its predecessors. The discovery comes close on the heels of revelations earlier this year that another U.S. software giant, Lotus, had built a National Security Agency help information trapdoor into its notes system, and that security functions on other software systems have been deliberately crippled. The first discovery of the new National Security Agency access system was made 2 years ago by British researcher Dr. Nico van Someren, an expert in computer security, but it was only a few weeks ago when a second researcher rediscovered this access system. Within it, he found the evidence linking to the National Security Agency. And then 2 weeks ago, a U.S. security company came up with conclusive evidence that the second key belongs to a National Security Agency, like Dr. Van Someren, Dr. Andrew Fernandez, chief scientist of the Krypton of Morrisville, North Carolina, has been probing the presence of significance of two keys. Then he checked the latest service pack released for Windows NT 4, Service Pack 5. He found that Microsoft's developers had failed to remove a strip that the debugging symbols used to test the software before they release it. Inside the code were the labels of the two keys. One was called key, K-E-Y. The other was called N-A-S key, National Security Agency key. Fernandez reported his rediscovery of the two cap keys and their secret meaning, quote, to advances in cryptology, Crypto 99 conference held in Santa Barbara, California. So once again, we have multiple sources that they've been spying, and therefore we should now ask Bill O'Reilly, with the evidence that is that you said does not exist, we can prove it does exist. If you doubt this, then Mr. O'Reilly, why don't you invite Stephen Cohen on? He has all the evidence, prima facie evidence. And then why don't you let those lawyers, the two female lawyers you have on every day, who would have been perfect in Mussolini's Italy and trying partisans, why don't you ask them, why don't they go after this now? Stephen Cohen, your final thoughts.
Well, I think that the national security state has pushed around whistleblowers in a way that actually threatens national security. By stripping these whistleblowers of all protections under law, which they have, which is just unbelievable, the only group that doesn't have any, and by threatening them with severe criminal sanction, they've achieved two goals. One, keeping legitimate information from the American people that we need to in order to exercise democratic rights, and two, driving whistleblowers underground and to take extreme action like Mr. Snowden and others, because there is no other alternative. And I think it's imperative that we not only take action on illegal surveillance that violates our constitutional rights, but there needs to be a major, major push to give national security employees legitimate whistleblower protections.
Thank you for coming on and setting the record straight here we have been spied on, our phones have been listened to. All the best to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Whistleblowers.org, and Stephen Cohen is the guest. Now let's shift immediately over to the San Francisco area, where standing by is Professor Stephen Souness, Professor of Politics and International Studies, University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East Studies. And he's recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of Middle East policy and of strategic nonviolent action. And he received his PhD from Cornell University and previously served on the faculty at Ithaca College, University of Puget Sound, and Whitman College. And he is an author of many different papers. But let's say hello to him. Nice to have you back with us.
Great to be on again.
If these groups of U.S. Supporters of Al-Qaeda, or I should say the U.S. supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria, have their way, there's not going to be any peaceful transition to power if the U.S. and some of its allies, like the French and the British and the United States, get its way and the Syrian regime is toppled. What are we going to have? Are we going to have another Tripoli? What is the likely outcome if we continue down this road of supporting the insurgents in Syria?
It's just going to mean more bloodshed, more tragedy. The United States says it's not supporting Al-Qaeda or the extremists, and I trust that that's their intent. But the problem is that not only do you have these explicitly Al-Qaeda-type groups involved, but even the so-called Free Syrian Army is composed of literally hundreds of independent militia that do not recognize the more moderate exile leadership. Many of these are just as extreme as Al-Qaeda, in both in their tactics and their ideology. And, you know, a shoulder-fired, you know, rocket launcher, which could, you know, theoretically protect a village from Syrian helicopter gunships, by shooting it down, could also shoot down a civilian airliner. And we can only think about Afghanistan, where 80% of all the billions of dollars we sent to the Afghan Mujahideen went to the most radical of the half dozen or so Mujahideen factions, as known by as Hizb-e-Islami or the Hekmatyar faction. And that group is now allied with the Taliban and is killing U.S. forces.
Take us through the arguments given, this so-called mythical, magical line in the sand that the weapons of mass destruction, such as chemical, the sarin gas, A, to my knowledge, I look carefully, we cannot independently confirm who used this sarin gas, since it was 2 weeks to get the blood samples of the people it was used on. And why does this president and this national security state and this military industrial state, why do they need to go into Syria? What's in Syria that is so important that they would commit themselves doing a repeat of Iraq all over again with the same type of lies?
Well, Assad has long been a thorn in the side of the United States in the region. It is the virtually the last of the left-leaning secular nationalist governments that at one point dominated the Arab world. It's a pretty horrific dictatorship by any measure, and the vast majority of the atrocities that have been going on have been committed by the regime. Yet the humanitarian argument, I think, it ignores the fact that by sending in more arms to the rebels, it's going to just increase the killing. I mean, statistically, historically. Whenever you, even in the name of humanitarian intervention or support for armed groups fighting an oppressive regime, it generally ends up just prolonging the conflict and getting more people killed. I mean, close to 5,000 people were killed during or slaughtered really by the Syrian regime during the first 6 months six to 8 months of the resistance, when it was overwhelmingly nonviolent. But that the rate of killing has multiplied to close to 90,000 since they've taken up arms and given the regime the excuse to crack down even further. But so it can't really buy it. I mean, I don't know about the chemical weapons charges, but certainly most of the human rights abuses that have been reported by the Syrian regime seem to be accurate. But again, sending arms into that situation is going to lead to more people being killed. But the interesting thing about Assad is that as much as we oppose his anti-Western and stance, U.S. has been willing to cooperate with him on occasion, him and his father. For example, we gave him a lot of flack for the Syria's domination in Lebanon for many years. It wasn't literally an occupation. It was more comparable to the Soviet domination of Eastern Europe during the Cold War. That was something that most Lebanese opposed. They were eventually able to push the Syrians out through a nonviolent uprising. What's striking is that when Syria originally moved its troops into Lebanon in 1976, it was with the support of the United States because we wanted them to crush this leftist revolution led by the Lebanese National Movement with the support of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And then they consolidated their control in December 1990 when the U.S. gave the green light for a coup against General Aoun, who was seen to be as an ally of Saddam Hussein. We've also cooperated with the younger Assad in crackdowns against al-Qaeda and other Islamic extremists, including making Damascus a part of the Extraordinary Rendition campaign. One more notorious episode was this Canadian of Syrian ancestry who was returning to Canada. He was changing planes at JFK in New York. And he unfortunately had a name very similar to an al-Qaeda suspect, and the U.S. arrested him, interrogated him, and sent him to Syria, where he was brutally tortured for more than 8 months. The U.S. never apologized. When he returned to Canada, a number of civil liberties groups and others wanted him to come to the United States. And to this day, the Obama administration refused to allow him to come. So we're quite willing to support. We're quite willing to support Assad and his father when their brutality was seen as to the benefit of U.S. interests. However, but by and large, we very much oppose this regime because they refuse to play ball with us like our other autocratic buddies in the United and in the Middle East, such as the Saudis and others.
It seems rank hypocrisy to say that our war on terror has necessitated taking our Constitution and shredding it, especially the Fourth Amendment, the First Amendment, because we have to go after the big terrorist, al-Qaeda. Now, it is absolutely palpable that we are supporting al-Qaeda in Syria as we supported al-Qaeda and the insurgents in Libya. Look at Libya today. We predicted this on this radio program. We said that you've got 2,000 different tribes and you've got ethnic divisiveness. You're going to have total chaos and civil war there with no stability. That's exactly what's happened.
Very much so.
I predict the same thing will happen. What's the likely outcome in Syria if we continue down this stupid path?
Far worse than what happened in Libya, actually. I mean, Libya is bad enough. On the one hand, they did have democratic elections and a relatively moderate coalition came to power. That's fine and good. And you know, Gaddafi was bad news. It's, glad he's gone. But the problem was that in a country of barely 6 million people, you have 200,000 men under arms in militia, many of which are allied to al-Qaeda and similarly minded extreme Salafi groups that have no allegiance to any government. They're throwing their weight around. They essentially control towns, even where they may have elected democratically moderate mayors and local authorities. These are the kind of folks that were responsible for the killing of the U.S. ambassador and three other Americans in Benghazi. And that's the questions we should be asking about that incident. You know, how do we get these guys in that kind of position in the first place, so rather than some of the it's always stuff the Republicans are raising. But in any case, the situation in Syria would be far, far worse because, you know, there are certainly tribal differences in Libya, but you know, ethnically and religiously, you know, people are a lot more similar. Whereas in Syria, you have a number of religious minorities, Alawites, Christians, Druze, Shias, in addition to the majority Muslims. You also have the division between Arabs and the Kurdish minorities. You have this ethnic division as well. Now, Assad is nominally a secular leader. He has favored people from his Alawite background, not for religious reasons, but you know, more for tribal reasons. But you know, these Salafi extremists are targeting, you know, Alawites as a whole, and so we're starting to see these ugly sectarian divisions that were largely absent in Syria, and that certainly is a very ugly turn of events. The other problem, and this is another why it's worse in Libya, is that Gaddafi, by the end of his rule, had pretty much alienated everybody, left, right, Islamist, secular. You know, I mean, in terms of public opinion, you know, he was probably down to single digits during his final years in power. But Assad, despite his many faults, still has a fairly sizable social base. His divide-and-rule policies have given him the support of the majority of these religious minorities. He also, through the crony capitalist class he's developed among the Sunnis, you have a lot of people who have, you know, are dependent on the regime. The Ba'ath Party has ruled Syria for more than a half century. You know, they've had offices like in every, you know, neighborhood and town, and patronage systems and things like that. The army is much bigger. So the Assad regime has support of close to a third of the population. So this really is a civil war. It's not just a popular uprising against an unpopular regime. It really is a much more of a civil war. And then to complicate things still further, you have people, you know, who may have even participated and supported the nonviolent pro-democracy movement, which was one that did, in large part, I believe, support a more pluralistic, inclusive Syrian society. But now that it's gone to arms, it's become an existential struggle between two extremes. So there are people who are saying, as god-awful as Assad is, it's better than if some of these crazies end up taking over. And so it ended up solidifying it. And because Assad has been so strong at playing the nationalist card in face of U.S. and other Western hostility, for the United States to get involved, even indirectly, just plays right into his narrative, and that he is defending the homeland from the Western imperialists and whatever, and that ends up strengthening him politically, and even far more significant than the arms we may, you know, send the rebels. So again, with very little central coordination or whatever, it's not going to really help them strategically. It's just going to result in more people getting killed.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you sharing these insights with us. Professor Stephen Zunes, Professor of Politics and International Studies, University of San Francisco, and one of his more recent publications is Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. His website is stephenzunes.org. Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you very much for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow.
Penso che un sogno così non ritorni mai più. Mi dipingevo le mani e la faccia di blu. Poi d'improvviso venivo dal vento rapito e incominciavo a volare nel cielo infinito. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, nel blu dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù, e volavo, volavo felice, più in alto del sole ed ancora più su. Mentre il mondo pian piano spariva lontano laggiù, una musica dolce suonava soltanto per me. Volare, oh,
del blu, dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù. Ma tutti i sogni nell'alba svaniscono perché quando tramonta la luna li porta con sé.